Welcome to episode 42 of the Corporate Real Estate Insider Podcast. Brian Connolly is coming to us from a different set. Looks like he is in, I don't know, prison somewhere with a brick wall. Very strange, but he's here. He made it. Owen, looking good. John, I know you want to kick us off today with a little bit about some high profile people talking about work from home. Take it away.
Let's go. Yeah, I think most people probably saw this headline. It was a big one. And it was Eric Schmidt, you know, former CEO at Google, speaking out about the in-office policy at Google. He was talking to a bunch of students at Stanford. And here's the actual quote. Google decided that work-life balance and going home early and working from home was more important than winning. Schmidt told Stanford students. And he goes on. And the reason startups work is because the people work like hell. I'm sorry to be so blunt, Schmidt continued in the video posted on Stanford's YouTube channel on Tuesday. But the fact of the matter is, if you all leave the university and go found a company, you're not going to let people work from home and only come in one day a week if you want to compete against the other startups. Like, there it is. Really bold. And then he took a whole lot of flack and he had to go walk it back. And who's he to be talking about Google, except he was there. But I thought that was pretty interesting. There's a lot of people that I think share that sentiment.
So there's, in addition to Eric Schmidt, there's been a lot of other people that have recently come out and made comments around the performance culture of being in the office and with the detriment of working from home, especially for high performance teams. Ken Griffin, a legendary hedge fund manager, leader of Citadel, he said in regards to their very strong performance, he said, it set up one of the greatest moments ever in the history of finance, getting to compete with people wearing their pajamas. And that is in response to their very early return to the office following the pandemic and also ending last year up 24.5% from an annual return standpoint. So kind of interesting. I mean, you see the, you know, consistently highest performing people. I mean, Eric Schmidt, you know, was CEO of Google through, you know, a dramatic period of success. You know, Ken Griffin, I think, is, you know, just renowned as one of the smartest people that's ever lived in finance, certainly one of the most successful. And there's countless examples of this, right? Tons and tons of people coming out and making these similar kinds of comments. And it's true. I mean, there was a survey talking about if you were founding a new company and you had the option to have your team in the office full time, part time, or fully remote, what would you be more scared to compete against? And then everyone said that they'd be more scared to compete against a team that is fully, you know, in the office and collaborating together. So anyways, no surprise, pretty interesting. It definitely seems that people, when they're being honest, you know, like Eric being brutally honest and then having to back it up, that everyone sort of is building consensus around that in person is the highest performance culture possible.
Well, to be clear, we've been saying that consistently since day one. This idea that over time, you know, that the companies that come together that are working together are going to win in a competitive marketplace. So that's what's going to draw people in eventually, is the idea that it's what it's going to be required to win in a competitive marketplace. So here's Eric Schmidt saying it out loud to Stanford students. But I think it's been consistent with our message.
I'll add, I just sent this to a client. If you all recall Mark Benioff in 2022 coming out and saying that office mandates are dead and flexibility is king, right? And just, I don't know if it was last week or the week before, Salesforce just announced a new policy for all 75,000 employees in which a good majority of them are going to be in the office 4 to 5 days a week, and effectively the balance, other than you know, full hybrid or full remote employees that are not near offices, everyone else is coming back at least 3 days a week. So a complete shift for another major company recently, kind of continuing to highlight the trend that companies, especially in a weak jobs market. Now, we just had our most recent jobs report come out that was below expectations. I think it was 100 or 150,000 positive net jobs, and revisions for previous months that revised downward. I don't have the stats right in front of me, but we are seeing certainly a labor market that is shifting back to the employer. And you're starting to hear employers, CEOs, leaders of companies be more vocal about getting their people back. I don't think that's, a surprise. I think companies have always felt this way. I just think that employees have had too much power to force the issue. And as soon as there's been some cracks in the armor here, you're seeing these leaders come out and tell you what they really felt all along. Personally, that's my opinion.
We've got to use that as a segue to Owen. Aren't you going to talk a little bit about what we read about a new CEO?
Yeah. So for my friends in Seattle here, I think for those of us who enjoy Starbucks like myself, and I've been a loyal customer for over, 30, 40 years. 30. We have a new CEO, Brian Niccol. And I think it's a good time, because Starbucks has certainly languished from, what it once was. A lot of people would suggest that, their customer base is falling off. Their most recent quarter showed a 6% drop in North American transactions. They've raised prices anyway. So they get a new CEO, Brian Niccol, right? And the news here today was that, Brian's allowed to work from home, in California and not at headquarters here in Seattle. But before people, just kind of react, I just want to provide a little context here, because I think there's two ways to look at this. Number one, this is someone Starbucks desperately wanted. They gave him a $10 million cash signing bonus, $75 million in equity awards when he joined Starbucks on September 9th. And all in, if he hits certain thresholds in his first year, he can make $117 million. And now that may seem like a lot of money, but Starbucks needs someone like this to turn their company back around. And I don't think Howard Schultz wants to come out of retirement for yet another stint as CEO. And so they're betting that Brian will be able to turn the company around. He is, he's in the prime of his career. He's 50 years old, and his track record for Yum Brands and Chipotle suggests that he is the guy that can pull this off. And so, Starbucks made, I think, an exception here to get the quality and the type of leadership they wanted. And granted, he's going to be in Seattle. I'm not suggesting he's never going to be here. They actually make comment that he's going to be on their private jet quite often, flying to and from Seattle to their corporate office. The challenge, and so I think that's all the good news, right? They have an amazing CEO. The world is his oyster, so to speak, and we'll see what he produces. The challenge, though, I think, from leadership at Starbucks is going to be, if they want their people back, which by and large they do, not suggesting they're a 5-day a work company, but it's going to be hard when the top leader in the company is afforded the opportunity to work from home. And granted, is he privileged because he's the CEO? One would suggest so, especially if he has the ability to make $117 million in his first year on the job. But again, it's kind of like one of those things where it's do as I say, not as I do mentality. If they ask their people to come back, they might get some people questioning, well, why does Brian get to work from home? So it'll be interesting to see how this all works out. But as a Starbucks customer and a Seattle resident, I'm cheering their success and hope Brian can turn the company around.
Now, I would think, Owen, this is just my personal opinion here, that his pay package to me is something that would be more upsetting to the culture of the company than him being in the office. I mean, what are the, of a company of that size with the problems that they have, like walk into any Starbucks and there's an issue across the board, the product types, the actual stores themselves, labor issues of closing stores because of organized labor. He's going to be on the road a lot, right? So it's not like they're going to see him in headquarters other than when he needs to be in headquarters, which he's going to be there anyway, right? I think, but that type of a pay package for somebody who's an outsider, they made a mistake with the last CEO and now they're just throwing a massive amount of money. To me, if I was on a leadership team there, I'd be like, what is our board doing, right? Is this guy really that valuable? I don't know.
Well, I think they, P&G and Yum Brands produces some amazing leaders in the food retail business. And I think they're betting on, hey, it's worth it if we can turn this company around, because certainly the last person couldn't do it. As a Starbucks customer, I can tell you they've lost their way, in my opinion. And there was a big article in the Wall Street Journal this past weekend about their declining consumer brand, fan base, if you will. And, you know, Starbucks, you know, the stores aren't as clean as they once were. They've gotten into sugary drinks. You know, it's not so much as a coffee place anymore. And their prices are absolutely insane, relative to their competition. So they've got to figure something out. And so, yeah, I wasn't in that boardroom. It would have been fun to be a fly on the wall when they were discussing his comp package, but, yeah, we'll see how this plays out.
Yeah, I'm really curious how it plays out too. I mean, when you think about the companies that Starbucks is competing against in today's environment compared to who it was competing against 10 years ago, it's completely changed. I mean, there's been a dozen national, really well-marketed brands that have emerged with way better prices. And when you think about Chipotle, it's sort of a category of one to a little bit. Obviously, there's other options for quick service food, but in terms of the value and health and the offering, you know, you think of like the Cavas, and it's like everyone sort of has a little bit of a different product. I feel like Chipotle doesn't really compete with someone that does the same thing or more or less the same thing. Whereas coffee, the product is from a consumer standpoint is much less differentiated. So I'm really curious how, you know, the new CEO will do. Obviously the, you know, board and investors think that this massive, you know, a multi nine figure investment into this guy is worth it, or they wouldn't be doing it. I've heard a lot of, you know, good things about him from digging into the supply chain and cost management and things like that. And just a matter of how much can that really do in a situation like this. So I'm you know, optimistic. I want to be, you know, cheering for Starbucks and anything, Howard Schultz related. I thought, you know, what he did to, you know, build that company and build the culture that they've had is really cool. So it would be a shame to see it sort of slowly fade.
Yeah, and I agree with you, Tucker. It's Howard Schultz has built an amazing company, a loyal customer myself, usually just because of the convenience. But what really drew me to Starbucks, and let's bring it back to the real estate business, is his concept of the third place, right? And I tell clients, I tell prospects, I tell anybody who will listen to me, when I speak, that the reason I'm in this business is because I truly believe that the workplace is important to people's lives, how happy they are, how fulfilled they are, and being able to help companies come up with amazing real estate strategies and locations is fulfilling for me, because, you know, you're helping people with their daily lives. I really believe that. And Howard just kind of took that concept to a coffee shop and created this concept of a third place. Like, you go into a Starbucks back in the day and you'd want to hang out there. You'd work there. You'd meet friends there. You'd have interviews there. Now you go in and it just feels like they're trying to push you out the door. So much so, the one that I go to by our old office, they took all the furniture out because they didn't want people in there. So I'm like, what are they doing? And they just had, so everyone just stands around waiting for their takeout orders, which come out with no organization. They just throw them on a counter. And so there's no alphabet organization. There's no, like, you go into a local coffee shop that does takeout, at least they organize it by like A's and B's and C's and D's. And it's like simple things. Starbucks, like, throw it all at you. And you try, and something's wrong, you try to get a hold of someone. If you can't, you have to go stand in the line or like scream over the top. Like, there's no connection to their customers. And it used to be in, like, you're going to sit in your living room with your friends. Like, how bad can it get? Right. And I used to really think that you could put these in the first floor of an office building and add some Wi-Fi and it could be an extension of the office. And it's a really great amenity for your employees. Now it isn't. It's just takeout. Might as well go to McDonald's to get your coffee.
Brian oscillates between thinking that this is a Starbucks public forum town hall where he can criticize, you know, get ideas out there for implementation, and a podcast about corporate real estate. So jumping back, very interesting around the third place, and agreed. I think the third place is something that has very much been lost as, you know, sort of in this post-pandemic era. But the question that I want to ask you guys is, where do you think all of this fear comes from around being honest around being in the office, right? Like, everyone knows that Eric Schmidt's unfiltered view is exactly the quote, right? That, you know, Google decided that work-life balance and being home early and being able to have more flexible work hours, they decided that that was more important to them than winning. That's what he believes. That's what he said before he had to walk it back. I find it strange that so many of these leaders, particularly really successful ones, are like afraid to actually be honest around what they think. And I'm curious why. Like, why do you think everyone else isn't more confident around saying, hey, this is what I believe, this is what I'd like to see, and maybe we're not there yet, but hopefully we'll be there eventually?
I'll just add, I'll remind us all of the Elon Musk quote that these people can go and pretend to work somewhere else. I thought that was pretty spot on. And that's just a couple of years ago.
So I'll take a shot at that, Tucker, because I do give this a lot of thought. And just watching my clients, it just, and I think I hit on it briefly earlier, it comes down to people. There is such a war for top talent that they are so laser focused on trying to create a company that attracts these people, and they'll effectively do anything to keep them there once they get them. Right. And it's really about the people. And if the, and if the largest employers, everything, someone told me this a while ago, like everything gets set by the largest companies, all, and then everybody else kind of follows suit. So if you have the largest employers allowing their people a lot of flexibility, everybody down below that has to follow suit. And everyone's competing for the same people. So how, if Google's at 3 days a week and I was at 2 days a week, I can try, hopefully I'm not Google, but hopefully I can win that employee because I'm giving them more flexibility, and it's a race to the bottom. So I think it all comes down to the labor markets. It all comes down to how the largest companies and most prolific companies lead this back towards some sort of equilibrium, or at least some sense of normalcy, whatever that is. And I think the CEOs, as they start to see opportunities in the labor markets to get more aggressive in bringing their people back, I think you'll see them doing it.
I think you're going to see them doing it for those that believe in that, though. I mean, I have clients of mine, actually many, that some that are 100% remote. Now, that's rare, I think, especially post-pandemic, but I still have some companies that, less a co-working space here and there for a touchdown, they embrace remote first. But I agree, when the labor markets, Brian, do start to tighten up, you're going to see more people being asked, or dare I say the word forced, to come to the office. I mean, the reality is, like, work is hard. And well, I shouldn't say it's hard for everybody. Maybe some people don't have hard work, but for the majority, you know, what we do every day, no matter what you do, no matter where you are in the spectrum of pay, when you go to work, it's exactly that. It's work. It's not play. And some of the hard part of work sometimes can be having to go to your place of work, whether that be a construction site, if you're doing manual labor, or if it's, you know, office work where you're in a climate controlled office space. It's hard no matter how you look at it, whether it's physical or mental. And so I think it's like, during the pandemic, it was easier in some respects to work from home. It's more comfortable. I'll admit, like, on days that I sometimes work from home in the morning or something, if I have to get kids to school, my wife's off doing something, it's more comfortable to be sitting at home in a jeans and a t-shirt, right? And from my home office. But I think it's a matter of, you know, how bad does the leadership that wants their people in the office, how bad do they want to fight that pull, which is, well, everyone else is letting people work home, you know, 3 days a week or 4 days a week or whatever that might be. It's going to take some hard decisions. And to your point, Brian, you have to have the labor market support those decisions, because right now, I think there's still the risk that if you draw that hard line, you might face some attrition, and maybe not, but who wants to take that risk given how hard it is to find labor in some cases? It's like, yeah, maybe you draw the line and you have almost no attrition, but if you get it wrong and your team actually does leave, then you're in a world of hurt, and you're better off of just staying status quo until greater forces allowed you to do otherwise. So it's really tough. And I'm not going to suggest that we know what's right for every single company, because like I said, I've got lots of clients that embrace remote work. But yeah, I think we'll see what happens with, you know, with this election this fall and interest rates and where the economy goes, because that could have a big shift on the labor markets and then subsequently the office market and occupancies in downtown Americas.
I wanted to challenge what you said, Brian, this idea that the largest companies are sort of setting the mark. And if they're allowing flexibility 3 days a week, people, smaller companies need to follow suit. And I would point to one word in the Eric Schmidt quote in particular, where he talked about these students graduating and going to work for a startup. And, you know, the brightest, most ambitious new hires would, I believe, willingly give away that hybrid work schedule, work flexibility to go to work with a team that's exciting and dynamic and that they believe is going to be an industry disruptor. And that team is going to come together and they're going to be together working in office 6 days a week. So it's those small industry disrupting startups that will set the mark. And that's who you got to compete with. So I don't think it is the biggest companies. I mean, right now we're sort of in this pendulum swinging and power between employer and employee still shaking out. But over time, what I think Eric Schmidt's referring to is the startup dynamic of a highly energized, highly ambitious team that I believe would recruit away the brightest and the best, who would willingly give up that work flexibility to be a part of a industry disrupting winning team.
Yeah. And let's just not forget too, guys, that a lot of this has to do with culture. I mean, it's, if you're going to ask your team to come back, you know, you can have the greatest office space in the world. You can be at a company making an amazing product or producing an amazing service, but it's, remember, for those that are like leaders in your company or you lead teams within your company, remember, it's what is it like to be at the office, not just the work you're completing on behalf of the customers or whatever the endeavor might be. The culture has got to nail it. And it's one thing to, like I said, have tricked out office space or, you know, offer a lot of benefits or a big salary or whatnot, but it's about the experience. And I can almost promise you, I mean, I would suggest this probably 9 times out of 10, that culture is going to trump comp. It's going to trump office space. It's going to trump what your company's mission is over anything. And that's what's going to get people in the office. That's going to get people enthused. Like Starbucks, if Brian Nickel has like insatiable, like passion for the Starbucks brand, a lot like what Howard carried forward over multiple tenures as CEO and founding that company. If he can bring that sort of passion to Starbucks to fire up their members, that's what they call their employees, that's going to get people more fired up to be in the office to reinvigorate and turn that company around. Because Brian's not going to do it on his own. It's going to take the thousands of people that serve and create that coffee experience for those like us on this pod to do it. And I think more important than him being in the office is him creating that culture that Howard founded many, many years ago, which is going to lead to their success.
I think it's a great chance to give a shout out and props to you, Owen. You are the poster child, in my view, for leading an in-office experience that is transformational for a team, for your team that we refer to frequently as the hardest workers in the room. I mean, no doubt, right? And here you have a young family, but you're right there, often the first one in while it's still dark. What you've done through the pandemic with a culture of hard workers winning in a competitive marketplace is really the poster child. And I wonder, you know, what could happen if you were fully remote and trying to lead this team in that way. I don't know how he does it at Starbucks. Good on him. But I just wanted to shout out to you, thanks, Owen, as a leader that has modeled that, and the results speak for themselves.
Well, it's easy to do when you're in the boat and everyone's rowing together, because it's not Brian Nickel pulling Starbucks across the finish line. He's going to have to somehow get everybody in the boat together, all rowing in unison, all pulling for the same purpose. And when he does, that's when you kind of start celebrating the glide, so to speak. So I'm confident he'll get there. I hope he is, for the shareholders' sake and the board, for his massive comp, but it will pale in comparison to the success if he nails it. So that's a good wrap up for that kind of segment.
Yeah. I just want to add one comment that it's no surprise to me that this is, you know, that people are coming out against it, right? Because it comes down to me, if like communication is so important in the culture of a company, it can get, even in a small company like ours, it's really important to over communicate, because people take things the wrong way. Messages get lost. The direction being in the office, right, is so important in communication. It comes down to this. It's like 85 to 95% of communication is nonverbal. So how much of the communication are you losing when you're not there with your people? And it's pretty simple. And as soon as you start to take that and expand it across months and years and across a large organizations, you can see why you can lose your weight pretty quickly, because you're not there enough. And is it 5 days a week? It's probably not, right? It doesn't. No one was going to the office 5 days a week before the pandemic, by and large. It was a lower number than that. So it's indicative of just human nature. We do not have the ability to communicate other than verbal communication remotely. It's, you know, we're not there yet. Maybe someday we will be. And I think that'll be a game changer for organizations. But for now, you just got to be in person to be able to really build that culture and build a team that wants to work together and win together.
I've got a story of an office building sale. Good old, we talk about this a lot, but it's kind of a poster child for what's happening. And it has some elements. It's in your market, Brian, maybe you can speak to it. But I was reading, here's the headline. RMR Group sells Boston area office at major loss as firm doubles down on apartments. I'll leave the apartment piece alone. They're sort of reinvesting into the multifamily space. But on this particular asset, the Massachusetts-based investor finalized the deal earlier this month to sell a vacant office building for $7.8 million. They, in 2010, bought it for $40.5 million. It was a single-tenant office property. It was occupied by the state's Department of Elementary and Secondary Education. And so this idea that large single-tenant buildings are tremendously risky if you lose that single tenant. It reminded me of my, I'm picking on that Amazon for sale office building in Tempe. I just went and looked on CoStar and it's still for sale. You know, who wants to own a large single tenant asset in this office market? But from 40 million to 7.8 million, brutal. I don't know if you know that property or you know that submarket. Where was it? Malden, Massachusetts. Is that a bustling up market?
So Malden, Massachusetts, how can I describe that? That is like the expansion market to the expansion market when Boston's really hot. So you've kind of got, you know, the explosion out of the core or Cambridge. Then you get into Somerville and Watertown, and then you get into Charlestown and Waltham and Lexington. And then you get into, you know, Southern New Hampshire. And then you get into San Diego and San Francisco. And then when you have no place else to go, you go to Malden. not quite that bad, but pretty close. It's a very difficult place to get to. It's a very difficult market to create, see any core of these types of uses. So it's a government, you know, it's a government user market, or it's used to be call centers. I had a client that had a large, like 600 or 700 person call center there. One of the big insurance companies, I want to say Manulife, that's what it was, Manulife, I think, had a big call center there. All been closed and shut down. So it's very close to the city, so it has an opportunity. It's Tufts University is right there, but it's just not a core market. So when that single tenant building goes vacant, the chances of leasing it are very, very difficult. For a multi-story office building like that. So I'm not surprised. It's, you know, I think it's more indicative than to RMR. Well, I will give them props on their massive renewal with Vertex. They own the Vertex headquarters in the Seaport. They bought it from the developers and have owned it for a number of years, I think in their hospitality REIT. But RMR in general has got a pretty tainted reputation. They had a major shareholder revolt lawsuit for excessive fees paid to the management company of the REITs, basically on the backs of the shareholders. And there was a management shakeup many years ago. They have a very unique way of doing deals. I've tried to renew clients, and if it doesn't, like, they've got a spreadsheet that they will send you. And if it doesn't hit the number in the spreadsheet that it has to in the pro forma to the REIT, they won't do the deal. They'd rather the client leave the building. So I had a client that was 150,000 feet. They left. We went literally across the street. You could hit it with a 9-iron, and the building sat vacant for 5 years. They sold it vacant, or the bank took it back, or something. So, there's just a very unique structure. And it's never one that I've been very impressed with in terms of their decision making, and their ease of doing deals is another one in Indianapolis. Two massive buildings that they owned. A client was in it on both buildings. We wanted to downsize and renew on one of them. There was like 3.5 years of lease term left, or we were going to pull out totally. because there was a lot of changes going at the company. You could read in the paper and they wouldn't do the deal. So we waited and we moved out of both buildings, and those buildings are still sitting vacant today. I don't think they own them anymore. So, RMR is management style and decision making is very unique.
Hey, Brian, any other companies you want to hammer on this podcast? Man, you're coming in hot. Okay, I'll put a bow on this conversation about the Malden, Massachusetts building. I think it speaks to something else we've said consistently, and that was this idea of like, who are the buyers that are going to emerge for these assets at these distressed sale prices? And this one, United Properties, a local management firm, bought the building, and that's consistent with what we've said. The buyers are going to be the local developers, builders, office investors who, you know, they've been there investing in the market for 20, 30, and 40 years, and here they have a chance to buy it for $7.8 million, where it was selling at $40 million 12 years ago. So local office investors stepping in, consistent with what we said, we've said all along.
And listen, guys, we're not going to drive listeners to this podcast being boring. Somebody has to step up. And if somebody's not a good operator at some point in history, you got to bring it up, right? So I'm sorry that I may have offended somebody. They have had those issues in the past. I did tell them, congrats on the huge renewal with Vertex. That was a massive million square foot deal. It's probably 10 or 15 years. It is a huge hole in the neighborhood where I work if they left. So thank you for the renewal. Thank you for getting that deal done. And you know what? We all want to be better. So, and we all want to drive listeners. So I'm not sorry.
With that, let's transition to co-working. Brian, we love your enthusiasm, genuinely. Okay, hey, I'm going to switch things over. This is a quick hit on co-working. And we all know what co-working is. We all know the rise and kind of somewhat fall of WeWork. But I want to just touch on Industrious quickly. They, you know, obviously are much like WeWork, certainly not WeWork themselves, but they offer the same type of product. And there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that I really enjoyed reading this morning, which talks about the difference, though, between the two of them. Because unlike WeWork, which grew by signing long-term leases, we're talking like 10 to 15 years of term, and then renting spaces to the occupants of the co-working space on short-term basis, Industrious has done something different. They use a management agreement model where they share the profits with the landlord. And this approach certainly, you know, limits upside in high demand markets, such as the markets pre-pandemic, but it also massively reduces the risk during downturns like we're experiencing right now. And downturns for landlords, that is, not necessarily a downturn for tenant, because the terms that we're achieving are fantastic for our clients. And their model is really gaining traction as what has become the new industry standard for co-working. So if you're a tenant out there and you're just curious how these people make money and how these deals get done, it's more and more becoming the norm that the co-working operator signs a management agreement with the landlord, and they're sharing in the profits of the rent that you're thereby paying to be an occupant. Industrious now has or manages over 200 locations, including, this is the weird one, including WeWork's former Midtown Manhattan headquarters. And they're privately held. They do have a $300 million investment that was made by CBRE, the world's largest, you know, commercial real estate company that serves landlords. And that was done in 2020. And they've merged with other companies as well, but they still are privately held. And there's rumor has it that the CEO, who's now 42, is considering an IPO, maybe in the next year or two. So we'll see where this goes. But, they've had a much more balanced approach to their growth. Unlike some, you know, startups, they've shied away from traditional VC early on in their growth. And they, by doing so, they just grew steadily over time versus, you know, the explosive growth that we saw with Adam Neumann and WeWork. But it remains to be seen what happens here. But I would say that, you know, by and large, they're doing all right, it seems like. I mean, I have clients that lease space from Industrious, some that just, you know, consider them as an alternative to other options in the markets. And every time we go through their facilities, they're pretty well occupied. And they're going to feel a lot like WeWork. Like, if you haven't been to an Industrious, but you've been to a WeWork, they're going to feel and look the same for the most part. Obviously, they're going to tell you they're a lot different, but the reality is it's just co-working. Anyway, it was a good article in today's paper. If you want to read more about it, it's in today's Wall Street Journal.
Hey, can you tell us more about that, Owen? Like this management agreement, so they're not signing a lease for the building; they're actually just signing a management agreement and operating the space for the landlord.
My understanding, yeah, that's the way the article. So, landlord obviously gives them some sort of a licensing agreement to use the floor, there, it's a profit sharing. So again, like the benefit to the co-working operator is it massively reduces their downside risks during times like we have today. Now, they're obviously losing a tremendous amount of upside if the market ever gets on fire again and vacancy falls and there's a line at the door for people to rent space in co-working. But I think that's a risk they're willing to take in exchange for limiting the downside.
Yeah, these rent share agreements are becoming the standard for co-working, right? And it makes a lot of sense. The landlords don't have to put out these huge capital TI allowances because previously they would sign these long-term leases and get huge capital payments from the landlords to build the space. The downside, and I should continue on. So the upside is you have a lot more flexibility, a lot less debt or pressure to pay rent to the coworkers, so they can be more flexible with changing market conditions. The downside is, and I don't think we're going to see this anytime soon, is that if you are looking at the capital value of an asset, it's very difficult to underwrite the coworking space, right? What's the value? What's the rent? And it's all about future cash flow. How does that building sell into the capital markets if you don't have a predictable future cash flow for whatever portion of the building is your co-working space, right? So that's the downside. But right now, everything is about occupancy. Everything is about having bodies in seats, you know, and when you're selling a building or you're refinancing a building, more importantly right now, I think is the lenders will go in and they'll go in and start to look at how many people are showing up to the building every day, how many people are in that co-working space. So it's important to have bodies and seats. And right now they drive people to the building, which is good for the other floors that are vacant. It's good for the operations of the building because of, you know, people pay operating expenses and taxes and those things. So I think as buildings retrade and you're getting a repricing of office assets, it'll become much more favorable because you're not trying to reach these new highs. You're not trying to continue to create a financing model that allows you to continue to reduce cap rates and sell the building at a higher multiple. You're just looking for occupancy and cash flow, and these bring people to your building. Certainly right now in a market where a lot of buildings are sitting vacant. And by the way, the Industrious product is a good product. I've got clients in it. I think highly of them. I think there's a bunch of others out there that are doing really well as well. And if they're well capitalized, if you have the centers that have enough people to make them cash flow and be able to provide the services that they intend to provide, it's great. And Industrious is doing a good job. They provide a high level service and it's a really meeting the market where it's needed.
So as we see co-working transition to more of a hotel hospitality type of ownership model where, you know, there are these management agreements, one of the things that I've found is incredibly inefficient with these management agreements is every individual owner at every different asset has a different pricing strategy. And there are many assets around the country, and this isn't specific to Industrious, but rather any co-working operator that's operating under a management agreement where they have just chronically mispriced their building and they're sitting on tons of empty space. They're not competitive with other co-working options. And if you actually talk to the people at the co-working center, they say, hey, this is a management agreement structure. We don't have any pricing flexibility. Every deal needs to be approved by the actual owner of the building, and they aren't willing to be flexible on price. And then you see these buildings just sit empty for super long periods of time. Whereas in the hotel market, generally, you don't see that. Generally, you have the ability to price rooms held at the operator level and not at the owner level. And that's a big change from these management agreements for co-working in office buildings. And I think that somehow that needs to be cleaned up to create a market that is more efficient for prospective occupants of co-working space.
Totally. Tucker, you make a great point. I think at the end of the day, companies are going to continue. You're seeing just the other side of it. You're seeing companies become a lot more cost conscious. You're seeing companies looking at their portfolios differently. They certainly want to start to find ways to get people back in the office. But I think flexibility is going to continue to be a huge component of how companies view real estate in this uncertain time, both from a demand and occupancy perspective, but also from the underlying health of the business and health of the U.S. consumer right now. So I think there's going to be continued demand moving into these assets and these centers all across, from enterprise level companies that are signing multi-site operating agreements to your individual startups that are just doing one-offs with, you know, a particular center in a particular location. So,
yeah. And I think the other thing that's, you know, beneficial to having, you know, the success of co-working in your building is it just brings life. Like, you walk into buildings today that have, you know, a lot of vacancy. It's depressing. There's nobody in the lobbies. There's no retail because there's nobody in the building to support the retail. So I think owners, you know, can get behind this new agreement, so to speak, with how to attract and retain co-working, because not only does it bring occupancy in the building, but these are all prospective companies that might lease space in your building should they outgrow the co-working. So I think it's a good solution long term, where you'll see more of these types of spaces, you know, be curated within the buildings themselves, with these owners in sort of a partnership agreement, like we've been discussing here, for the benefit of everybody. I mean, thankfully in Seattle, our building is predominantly, you know, very, very well occupied. We've got very little vacancy here where we work, in Seattle, we being Hughes Marino. But I go into buildings every single day on tours with clients, and man, when you go into a building that's 50%, 30% occupied, it's pretty depressing.
It's interesting that I don't think we've ever said that out loud. And it's maybe a bit of a contrarian notion, this idea that maybe co-working is going to have a moment or is having a moment. And it certainly follows logically. If you think about all the dynamics in office leasing, flexible scheduling, hybrid work, even the companies that are fully occupying their space are maybe only occupying it 3 days a week with a 50% utilization. So, you know, when operated correctly, you would think that co-working might be a part of the solution coming out of this change. Never really thought about it that way, but hey, maybe we're bullish on co-working when it's done correctly.
Yeah, the interesting thing that I'm looking forward to seeing how this plays out, and we're getting pretty deep on this discussion, but there's been a lot of landlords over the past year or two or three that have tried to get into co-working themselves and build out spec suites. When I say spec suites, I'm referring to suites that are already pre-built with furniture, kind of plug and play. You can walk in tomorrow and start working. Not trying to go full co-working, but they're trying to take that model and carry it forward for their own sake and not have to share those revenues. It remains to be seen how that works out. I'm of the opinion that you should let the co-working companies do co-working, let the landlords do what landlords do best, which is lease space in their buildings. It's not to say it couldn't work, but I just feel like, you know, let's remain within our domain expertise. Much like we at Hughes Marino represent tenants. So we'll see how this kind of plays out. But we could unpack this and go deep, but this has been a good discussion.
So taking a page out of Brian Prison Connolly's playbook for today, John, I'll go out and say that I am not bullish on co-working at all. Maybe bullish compared to the depths of COVID, maybe bullish compared to, you know, WeWork implosion days, but just fundamentally as a business, these businesses suck, right? They're incredibly capital intensive. You have long-term leases. There's not really anything preventing new competition from running into the market. You don't actually have that much pricing power. And you just think about the cost to actually operate these things. It's so challenging to make the economics work. You have to charge so much rent to actually make these work. And yeah, does co-working work on a like 1, 2, 5, you know, sub 10 person company basis? Sure, right? Because there's not really a solution for those people that's as affordable. If you need a, you know, receptionist, or you need someone answering the phones or getting your mail, that shared service model really does work for these much smaller companies that don't really have access to get space on their own. But when you're dealing with an enterprise level company, it's so challenging to make the economics of this work for large companies when the market is flooded with really attractive and competitively priced sublease space. So I don't like co-working as a business. I personally would basically never invest in a co-working company as like a shareholder, unless the price was like stupidly low. I just think they're bad businesses. It's the same reason that I would be, you know, really nervous about, you know, investing into a restaurant that has a super capital intensive build out that, you know, can have a restaurant open next door or across the street and undercut you. They're just, they're not very defensible, high moat businesses, and the margins aren't great. And you have to charge your customers so much to make them profitable, and you're taking all the vacancy risk yourself. I don't like them.
I totally agree with you, by the way. And what you're describing is the WeWork model, and they overspend and long-term lease commitments and then go make a margin on these short-term leases where you just get hammered the minute the market turns. I totally agree. That is a flawed business model, and we all saw it from the beginning. What I'm responding to is this notion of these management agreements where a specialized company will come in and maybe a landlord will take one or two or three or four of their floors in a significant Class A high rise and contract with this company to do this kind of marketing to these shorter term co-working tenants. So there isn't the long-term lease obligation. There isn't a need to cover the master rent in that management agreement style. I think that would be an interesting and functional business model.
I agree. It's a better business model, right? Because you don't have all of the fixed costs and the upfront costs and all that. But if you think about the product that you're actually providing as this co-working operator operating off of a management contract, you're providing a product that isn't really that compelling to your customer, right? If the model doesn't work when you actually lease and control the space, then why would it work when there's an intermediary charging fees, right? Like the product that you're actually providing to the owner of the building is not good. Like the product perhaps is better than what the product would be if you just have vacant, empty space, but someone's having to make that enormous upfront capital investment, then right. Pay this intermediary to manage and operate and all that, still have vacancy, still have re-tenanting costs, still have all those upfront costs. But now you're paying some operator 10 or 20 or 30% or whatever they're charging. Yeah, maybe you can justify it if it's for activating the building, getting more people in the building, having it feel less dead, as you know what Owen was talking about earlier, or if it is a marketing expense to say, hey, this is a way to get a company that goes from 5 to 10 people to 100 people to hopefully stay in our building and come talk to us on a direct basis. But short of that, like, it doesn't really make sense. It just doesn't. I mean, somebody's having to pay those costs and deal with those upfront fixed costs and take the risk, whether it's the WeWork type company or the co-working company, under a management agreement or a direct lease. It's like all those costs are still being spent. It almost doesn't really matter whose money it is.
Co-working has its benefits for the end user, the tenant. But just to kind of piggyback on Tucker's, thesis, which is it's not a great business that he would invest in, I would tend to agree. The other thing that he hasn't touched on, which he's well aware of course, is that all the agreements that tenants sign with these centers are 3, 6, 9, 12 months long. There's almost no predictable revenue. And you're banking on the fact that either A, someone's going to renew that lease with hope, or there's going to be enough demand that when that person decides to go somewhere else, there's going to be someone that comes in behind them. But that's the scary part for me if I was a co-working operator, is that you've got like revenue streams that are very hard to forecast and very cyclical and volatile. Would scare the hell out of me if I was an operator.
Okay. Say that you are, none of us advise landlords. All we do is advise, you know, occupiers of corporate real estate, right? But say hypothetically we're advising a owner of a 50-story office building. Maybe they have 10 full floors that are available, and you have the option to either say, hey, let's bring in a co-working operator and give them 2 or 3 floors, or alternatively, we're going to build 2 to 3 floors of spec suites. And the speculative suites that we build are going to be between 2 and 8,000 square feet. They're going to be really cool. They're going to be functional for a wide variety of types of tenants, and we're going to fully furnish them. The cost to do both of those is effectively the same. On one hand, you have, and now I go ahead and answer my own question, but besides the point, you now have space that's super functional for probably ever. The space has a useful life of 10 or 20 years for a normal type of tenant, or you build this co-working environment at a higher cost and then have a manager in the middle. Like, what do you do? Like, I'm convinced that probably 99 out of 100 times you were better off just building spec suites, fully furnishing them, offering them at a price that is maybe slightly above market. I think those spaces will lease so much faster than going and doing a co-working setup.
First of all, Tucker, I agree with your question and your answer, right? But the question I have for you is, why do we care if the landlords are building it? First of all, like, we represent tenants. And I would tell you that out of anything in the marketplace, this is co-working is a really great product for tenants. I don't really care if it makes sense for the landlords, because you look at it, WeWork went bankrupt and is going to be a whole different company. Regus went bankrupt, I think, 2 or 3 times, but I know at least once. The small mom and pop operators are constantly going out of business. It is a terrible business model, but it fills a massive void for companies. If you have a company that's looking at either a new market, they hire a new business leader, they need expansion, and traditional leasing is 5 to 10 years, but also just huge CapEx. Right. You're spending $300-$500 a foot to open a new $5,000 or $10,000 square foot office. You go into this temporary space. Let's see if that office has viability. Let's see if that location can hire based upon the plan that they put out, because you know how it works. You put a hiring plan out and you have to go see if those people are actually in the marketplace to find them. Even the data might suggest it. But maybe your comp structure doesn't work. Maybe your leader isn't somebody who can attract the people that he wants to lead. Use it as a test case, get a critical mass, and then go spend $500 a foot. It's a product that's awesome. From the perspective of the owner, first of all, if you're in that 6.5% that we talked about on the last podcast of the premium office space, you're going to build spec suites. Boston Properties is doing it floor by floor in the most expensive building in Boston, the 200 Clarendon, John Hancock Tower, have building entire 30,000 foot floors as spec suites because people will lease them at 5,000 and 10,000 foot clips. They're not doing any co-working. But if you have that class A minus, if you have that B plus building that no one wants to go to, I'd take the risk and put a co-working in there and see if you can get some occupancy. Yeah.
Okay. So let me answer. Now I get to answer the question. So first, I'm going to give you a little air cover, Brian, in case people listening are, you know, yelling at you. Regus has never gone bankrupt. Their parent company, IWG, did file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in 2003 after the dot-com crash to restructure. But that was just one time. So just heads up. I know people sometimes love to listen to pods and fact check. That's the facts. But I don't, it's like you, Brian. I'm like, whatever.
So they went bankrupt one time.
Chapter 11 bankruptcy is still bankruptcy.
They went bankrupt one time. I said, I know of one time. I thought it might have been more. So
let's get back to Tucker's answer, though. So here's his answer. So here's my answer on what I would do if I was advising a landlord, which I don't do, but if I did. To Tucker's earlier comment, the co-working space, in my opinion, works fantastic for companies, you know, 1 to 7 to 10 people max. After that, typically speaking, a majority of time, companies want their own space. And what I've found is when they see a spec suite that a landlord has built 2,000 to 5,000 feet, that it's own standalone suite where they're not sharing a glass walled fishbowl within a co-working floor, they much prefer those spec suites, those pre-built suites that are standalone. But what I do like co-working for are when those companies are smaller than those that need 2,000 to 5,000 feet, but want to be in a professional setting. So if I was advising a landlord, I don't think I would take 3 floors and give it to Industrious, my own 2 cents. I'd probably do a floor and tell Industrious, hey, this is how it's going to work, guys. We're going to let you, or it could be anyone, WeWork, Industrious, whoever it might be. We don't want you building out these, what they call enterprise suites, where they're larger than, say, 2,000 feet. We, the landlord, are going to do that on floors X, Y, and Z. But what we want you to offer is that smaller incubator space for those that we just don't have space for because they're too small. That, I think, is the perfect solution. But again, I don't represent landlords, nor do I own commercial office buildings. So that's my opinion.
Okay, so Brian earlier said, I don't care if it's good for landlords. we represent companies. Who cares about the landlords? Prison Brian is in a fighting mood today. Let me just say that right now. But the reason that it matters that it's not good for owners is that if it's not good for owners, then eventually the market is going to be more efficient and they're just not going to exist, right? Like, no one is going to sustain having these things that are not good for themselves over long periods of time. I agree that co-working offers a excellent solution for lots of short-term projects and for bridge space, even for large companies. Like, being able to go and get 10,000 square feet of space from WeWork for 6 months in basically any major CBD, that is really valuable. Like that fills a void that you can't get, you know, even if you go to a sublease, you might not be able to get through a negotiation period, sublease document and landlord approval. That could take 60 days. I mean, like, easily, it could take obviously much longer than that. Whereas you can go and see a WeWork and have a license agreement signed and move in 4 or 5 days later, like, easily, right? We've all executed on those really fast turnaround type projects. Without a co-working solution, I don't know how you do those projects as effectively, but I'm concerned that on a, you know, decade long timeline, that maybe these don't exist because they're just not very good business models for landlords.
So I want to say one thing, and then maybe this puts a bow on it. I don't know. What we're talking about here is the long tail of tenant leasing. And the question for the building owner is, do they want to chase it? Right? Maybe they don't. But this idea that the key in the long tail market segments is long. Like, if you can capture it, it's significant. And can you use technology? Can you use a partner? How do you do it? Is it worth it? The nicest Class A office building doesn't need to chase it. But for these other buildings that have vacancy, you know, if Industrious as an operator can come in and do the hard work and the management, I can see where a landlord would be tempted to chase this long tail of tenant leasing, the smaller singles, you know, cats and mouse, you know, short-term leases, smaller group operators. But it's the long tail of tenant leasing, and they can choose whether they chase it or not.
First off, thank you, Eric Schmidt, for creating Google, because in Googling Regis bankruptcies, they actually went bankrupt, Owen, in 2003. And then in 2020, 97 entities of Regis went bankrupt again. Thank you, Eric. But to Tucker's point, I think there's always going to be this, because one, we're going to see these types of rev share agreements. And if the market comes back, owners are going to push those operators to sign leases. The market will be strong enough to support it again. And we're going to be in the same cycle, I think. So that's still at a smaller scale, but they've been around for a long time. And at certain market cycles and in certain blocks of a building that are really tough to lease, I think they're going to be there. They're just going to make them sign leases again when market fundamentals require it. The other piece of it is, if you ever walk into a Regis, it was built in the 90s. There's a reason they're not upgrading these spaces, is because they have to reuse some of, they have to just put, you know, paint and carpet. They have to add some glass, but they don't really do the spaces over because of that CapEx. And there are hundreds of millions of square feet of WeWork space that's going to be co-working for the next 30 years. That's my opinion. So it'll be around. It's not going to continue to be as nice as it is today. There's going to be a declining value of that asset and that buildup, but they're not going to rip them out by and large if there's no other tenant behind them. We're just going to have to be using existing buildouts for the next 30 years.
Okay, there you have it. Thanks for a great episode 42. Pod friends, let's wrap up there. Been about an hour. Until next time, thanks everyone.